Become our friend on Facebook. Post on our wall your thoughts about our shows and network. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit VoiceAmericaVariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkgaard. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of Valerie, her guests, and callers. Now here's your host, Valerie Kirkgaard.
I am your host. It is October the 5th, and here we are. And what we got is a special program that we've actually been trying to get you for a couple of weeks. And we're going to pull it off today. Computer glitches have been an interesting conversation. So the world is getting in alignment, and the world is getting into peace, and the Republic is getting into peace. And C.W. Wright and I are here at Waking Up in America. We're just going to say hi to you in the beginning here, and then we're going to do this thing called the wraparound, which is we're letting you know what's happening right now, and then we're going to turn it over to you for a recording that was actually done towards the end of September. And I think you'll be very impressed with Jane Goodall. I'm 77 years old, and she's just an amazing human being. And we're just going to do a quick thank you to our sponsors, Emergency Management Solutions, also known as EMS Global One, Jason Winter T, LA Lifestyle, and YouHaveTheRight.com. And it's raining in the world, and CW has a smart thing to say about that.
Yeah, we got the sunshine in the East Coast at 75 degrees, and North Central America, it's 75 degrees, but here in Southern California, it's 64, and it's raining, and in my best Evangelica voice, it is cleansing in Southern California by the power of the shower.
The power of the shower, I like it. I think it's a perfect thing, and so what we want to do today is we're setting you up to shower the world with peace. It's all of this is a choice, and I was telling CW that I was in a grumpy mood, and what did you say?
I said what you're going to tell them.
See how quickly we pass that ball back and forth? What I said was, I'm going to get on the radio, because when I get on the radio with our listeners, then I remember the higher standard that we're all shooting for and we're all holding for. So there's about 100,000 people right now that listen to this. I'd like to multiply that by 10 really fast, CW.
Okay.
If we take this audience of 100,000 people and we ask them to hold the possibility of peace or the possibility of everybody having financial comfort in the world, and tell them really quick what a jubilee is. Because that's one of the things that's a possibility in this world, is a jubilee.
You describe the Jubilees better than I do, because the Jubilee, as I know them, is a biblical thing.
Right. That's exactly what I was thinking of, actually. It's every 7 years and every 50 years, as I recall. There's certain kinds of Jubilees where all debt is forgiven. And personally, I think we're due this.
And I don't know which one we're in right now. Are we in the seventh or the seventh generation? Let me see. The seventh year period, or are we in the 50 year period? I don't know which one we're
in. I'm going to claim both, because I don't want to miss anything. give me a chance. You say 7 or 50, I'll take them both.
Well, you know what? If you do the math, it's every seventh, 50th period, they are the same thing. Did you know that?
After 7 and 30, no. How do you mean?
Well, okay. As the 50th year, every 50 years, seven doesn't go in the 50 years evenly, nor does it go in 100 or 150
right.
or 200, 250, but it does go in evenly in the 350.
Huh.
So every 7th, 50th year period, the 7-year and the 50th year period is on the same exact day.
I think we should tell them to take some Protandin in case they got a headache with that math. Here's the deal, guys.
Get your Biofilm to go with that.
We think you're going to love the show. Really, if you want, I guess before we go, we got to turn it back over to Brad so he can play the interview. For goodness sake, we're enjoying ourselves too much. I did want to share, though, that I got a really bad scratch on my hand yesterday, and it was a gaping, bleeding wound. And today, I'm just astounded, actually, that it's in such good shape, my hand. And I really think it's the Prodantin that I'm taking. And so you can check that out on our website, and that's wakingupinamerica.com, and you'll be able to hear a replay of the show. So is there anything you wanted to say before we turn it over?
Well, I want everybody to have a healthy and prosperous day, and I hope everybody enjoys the interview as much as Val and I enjoyed bringing it to you.
And here comes the power of the shower, a shower of peace. Take it away.
Well, let me start this out properly here. CW just put this on. Normally, we'd have you on the air because of your schedule and our schedule. This is how we're going to do it, and then we'll play this for the radio station.
Right.
You want me to start over?
I'm going to take a little five-second pause here before I start, CW, and then I'll bring you in, and then we'll bring Jane in.
Okey-doke.
Oh, hi there, everyone. This is Dr. Val Kirkgaard, and you're listening to Waking Up in America today, and I have the privilege of having a conversation with a woman that I met originally 11 years ago now, who has been very busy much before that. You know her for her work with chimpanzees and gorillas. And speaking of gorillas, I've got a really redheaded gorilla here who is my partner.
Now, wait a minute.
I'm just saying it so she'll think you're really cute because she loves gorillas, honey.
Well, I actually never worked with gorillas at all, only chimpanzees.
Oh, only chimpanzees? Oh, my goodness gracious. Thanks for correcting me. So this blows my whole chimpanzee-gorilla thing with CW. Anyway, you'll love the guy. CW and I actually work in the Republic of the United States, and that's what I had mentioned to you about how we're on our way to the the Republic is on its way to the UN, and
right.
I've been awed, actually, over the years. I was awed, as I mentioned to you when we were talking earlier, that you actually travel 300 days a year.
I know. It's crazy.
It is crazy.
But the world is
needed,
so big.
Isn't it? It's crazy and needed, isn't it?
It's very needed. You know, if what I'm doing didn't make a difference, I wouldn't have to do it. And nobody'd be happier than me. But it seems that what I'm doing is making a difference. And there's so much wrong with the world that, you know, every little bit that every single one of us can do, we ought to do, I feel.
And you have an accent. What country do you come from originally?
England. If I have a home, it's in England, the house I grew up in, where my sister actually lives. And I just am like a bird of passage, but, you know, it is home. It's where all my things are.
What did you want to say, CW?
I want to let Ms. Goodall know my wife is from England, from Birmingham.
Yes, that's up much further north.
So I had jotted down when I had heard you speaking on the Peace Week call earlier, and today is Peace Day. The 21st of September, there's been a teleseminar put on for the last week by the Schiff Foundation with amazing conversations on peace. And when I saw your name, I knew that I had to be there and I had to connect with you. When I was listening to the call, you had mentioned something interesting about how you had arrived in Tanzania in 1960 and the forests were deep and beautiful.
Yes, that's right. It was a different world back then. You know, the chimpanzees, none of the apes were really facing extinction, and the forest stretched right across the equatorial forest belt. But now the forests are getting fragmented, the animals living in the forest are disappearing, the human populations are growing, the water, fresh water sources are shrinking, and, of course, people living in terrible, terrible poverty.
You know, I jotted down something, and I don't know that you actually said it, but it was my evaluation. You said that as you traveled around in behalf of the chimpanzees, that you realized that the chimpanzees were in trouble because you noticed the humans were getting in trouble.
Well, it was, I mean, I knew that the chimpanzees were in trouble because we know the numbers have plummeted and the forests are decreasing. But it was as I was learning about, talking about, raising awareness about the plight of the chimpanzees that I began to realize that unless we can raise people out of crippling poverty, then we're not going to be able to do anything for chimps or the environment. Because if you're starving and you have a family, you're definitely going to cut down the last trees to try and grow some food or get some money from charcoal. So only if we improve the lives of the people and suggest alternative ways of making a living other than cutting down the trees, can we really hope conservation efforts to succeed.
Well, as a woman of peace, how do you deal with it when you see that countries in greed are causing a lot of the suffering that you see?
Well, how I deal with it is traveling and talking to people. And one of the most important programs that we, the Jane Goodall Institute, has is Roots and Shoots. And that is a program for young people that was born out of my realizing that in so many of the countries where I was traveling, initially to talk about the plight of chimpanzees and rainforests, but I met so many young people who seemed to have lost hope for the future. They were either apathetic, which was most of them, or angry, or really depressed. And when I talked to them, they all said more or less the same. We feel this way because we feel that you've compromised our future and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, we have compromised the future of our children. There's no question. But it's not true that there's nothing that can be done about it. And so Roots and Shoots was born with a message of every one of us makes a difference every day. And every group of young people choose three kinds of projects to make the world better. One to help people, one to help animals, one to help the environment, with a very strong theme of learning to live in peace and harmony, not only with each other, but also with Mother Nature.
I also jotted down that Roots and Shoots was in 120 countries.
Yes, it's gone up to 126 now. It's honestly growing all the time. And we began with 12 high school students in Tanzania, and we've now got members of all ages, from preschool all the way through university, with more and more adults wanting to take part.
So how did you cause that expansion? So what year did you start Roots and Shoots?
Started 20 years ago.
20. That's a lot of countries for 20 years.
It's growing really fast. It's most countries fairly small. But, for example, it's every U.S. state. I don't know how many thousand groups we have in the U.S. And a group can be a whole school or it can be just a few kids. It's right across mainland China. Of course, it's all throughout Tanzania. It's growing really fast in Australia, South Africa. England has over 1,000 groups. Other European countries are. It's growing. Latin America is beseeching me to go to more and more of those countries because they want the program.
You had said something on the conference call that I really appreciated, and what you had said, I don't, forgive me because I don't remember your exact language, but basically you said that you weren't arguing with the parent or the adult, you were engaging the youngsters, the children. Would that be accurate? Did I quote that right, or is that the right intention?
Well, we certainly engage the youngsters, and one of the things that's very clear is that when youngsters get, fully engaged, they become very passionate. They are changing their parents. There's no question about that.
Yes.
And when you think that parents include business people and politicians, lawyers, you know, it's a very powerful tool for change, engaging the young people.
You know, I was listening to Deepak Chopra's conversation the day before, and I'm wondering if you could comment on something you said, because it resonated with me. He said, we are at a chaos point.
Yes.
And would you like to comment on that?
Well, we're at a point where, you know, if you look around at what we've done to the planet, starting off with the sheer numbers of population growth on the one hand, and the unsustainable lifestyles on the other, and the, you know, extreme poverty. So that's the kind of underlying trio of things. And then you've got all that we've been doing, which is leading to climate change and loss of fresh water supplies and miserable conditions for people and animals all over the globe, and so much more. We all know about these things. And so far, nature has been able to heal itself. And so far, people, or most people, have been able to rebound, most nations, I should say. But you can see, if you look around the nations, that there are states that are, you know, becoming extremely, well, take Somalia, places like that. And if you look at nature, there are places where you begin to wonder, can nature heal itself?
Mm-hmm.
So it is a state of chaos. But, you know, we're not there yet. We still have time. I'm quite convinced of that.
I'm glad to hear that. I remember talking to Noel Brown from the UN a number of years ago, and he was concerned that we would be out of time by the year 2010.
Well, I don't believe we're out of time yet. And even as I go around seeing doom and gloom everywhere, I mean, everybody tells me, Jane, can you sign this petition? Can you write this letter to a politician and so forth? I'm meeting incredible people and hearing about amazing projects. And it's also true that I don't think there are any of these doom and gloom stories where there isn't a group of passionate people working to put it right.
That is so. I don't know where I heard it, Jane, but I actually heard, and I know this sounds funny to say a small amount, but I actually heard that it would take simply $400 billion per year to put the environment back into good shape. Have you heard anything like that?
No, I haven't heard that figure, but I'm perfectly convinced that if we would put all the money into helping poverty and the environment, those two go together very much, that we put into fighting and war and war plays.
But
that's
business.
We would make a huge difference.
We have to convince the businessmen to give up their particular interest in that particular business. And
yeah, arms. That's a terrible business.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
It's been too profitable for too long.
Yeah, absolutely.
So actually, what year did you come to the UN?
What year? It was 2001, I think.
Oh, really? So you and I showed up at the same time.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Right. I think that's right.
That was one of the times I met you. It was there. A friend of mine, Dr. Murphy, he picked me up in a landmark seminar and asked me if I would be a stand for peace. Okay. And then he started sending me to these different conferences and things. And one of the things that he did was send me to the State of the World Forum.
Well, I went to the State of the World Forum, and it started in San Francisco, of course. That was 2000. And then I went to every single one. I mean, that was 1995. And I went to all of the UN, the State of the World Forum conferences.
Do they still have those?
No, they don't.
It was a remarkable event. The one that I was in was at New York, and I remember the meal ticket was $2,000.
Yeah, that was the last one. That was a sort of grand finale. The previous ones are all in San Francisco.
Well, I went to the grand finale,
yeah.
And met a lot of world leaders, and that ended up with me going to the UN and then later through the Global Security Institute. I ended up at the Nobel Laureates Conference in Rome in 2005.
Oh,
and just met some phenomenal human beings there. But at that time, it was all about George Bush.
Yes, of course.
And I was an embarrassed American, okay?
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Well, you know, the reason that Kofi Annan, it was when he was Secretary General, I was made a UN Messenger of Peace. And the reason he made me a UN Messenger of Peace was because of roots and shoots, because I was able to say, everywhere I go, I'm growing roots and shoots, and it's very much this program about breaking down the barriers between not only people of different nations, cultures, and religions, but as I said already, between us and nature. And so everywhere I go, I'm planting seeds of global peace. We, you know, we link these young people together. We have these giant peace doves that they fly during the UN International Peace Day week. And we've had Hutu and Tutsi flying doves together. We've had Israelis and Palestinians flying them on the two sides of the border. And so,
what happened in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday?
That was when we had the most amazing peace event. We had about 1,000 people sitting outside in the sunshine, and we had a discussion about peace and lots of questions from the audience. It was a very, very special day.
What did you cherish most about Tuesday?
I think really there was a feeling of peace. We had two of the giant peace doves that we flew, and I think it was, you know, the sheer number of people who'd come just to, well, to join in this celebration of peace and to learn what they could do to make the world a better place.
Well, you know, it's interesting because what you're mentioning, Deepak Chopra was talking about how you get peaceful is by living mindfully. And I like that. And he was talking about personal vow for peace was to take a few deep breaths before you said anything and smile to yourself first, and that you would actually then be setting the stage for peace before you answered the telephone, if somebody said something to you that you didn't care for, that you would take a couple of deep breaths and just smile and actually enter the conversation through a smile. And I thought that was really good advice. He also mentioned that sharing when you have very different people, such as the Israelis and the Palestinians. Somebody on the call was talking about what do you do if you have very different people or people that are upset with each other on the same stage. And he said, share love stories and a common goal, and that will bring people together. And I was wondering if any of that occurred naturally in what you were doing.
Well, I certainly I use stories. I mean, I continually. Oops.
You're forgiven.
No, it's not my phone that's ringing. So I tell lots of stories, and I think when you get different people who disagree with each other together, the most important thing is that they listen to each other, because mostly people who feel that they, oh, I'm sorry about this.
Don't worry about it. I actually, at the beginning of the show, say that if you hear telephones ringing or angels singing, we're in life.
Oh, we're definitely in life.
We are engaged in life, and
yes.
This is what it sounds like.
Wretched hotel. Anyway.
Don't let the Renaissance hear you say that.
Well, the windows don't open.
I know, and they don't open anywhere hardly anymore unless you go to a really old hotel.
What I always try to do. We actually have a thing saying Jane wants rooms with windows that open. And
I'm exactly like that.
Well, so anyway, peace. I always feel it's really important to listen to the person that you're in disagreement with. And I was taught that by my mother. Listen to what they say and think about it. And maybe there's a point there that you haven't thought about before. And then you can have that one point and say, well, gosh, on that, you're right. And that's the beginning of then an exchange of ideas rather than this, you know, aggressive finger pointing.
Mm-hmm.
And stories, indeed. I tell people stories, and it does make a difference.
Well, I'm going to ask you for your favorite story in a minute. CW is being very nice because I'm just doing this interview, and he's here. And what you don't know about him is that he's actually in charge of a company called Emergency Management Solutions. And one of the things that CW does is that he travels the world to make sure that people have the safety things that they need. And so with that in mind, CW, I thought, after Jane tells the story of one of her favorite peace stories, maybe you'd like to ask her a few questions.
I would. Thank you.
So, Jane, tell us a story, one of your favorite peace stories.
Right, I'll tell you a lovely story.
Oh, good. I love lovely stories.
From DRC, where we have a program to improve the lives of the people, to try and make a corridor linking up two national parks so that the chimpanzees, gorillas, and other animals can survive into the future and have the right genetic mix and so forth. And, of course, in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, it's a bit politically unstable, to say the least. And the militia keep sweeping through, and very few people have stayed. But we have a wonderful project manager, Dario, and he's managed to make contact with a lot of these people. Anyway, he's starting a route in Chute. The kids come to him, and they say, well, we discovered that that hill over there used to be a sacred hill, and it used to be covered with trees, and we've decided what we want to do is to put the trees back.
Whoa.
And so Daria looked at the hill, which is quite big, and he said, yeah, that's a great idea. So they all went off to various forestry departments and begged for seedlings and seeds. And then Daria had to go to the resident militia, whichever one was there at the time, to get permission. And they said, well, yes, I suppose that's right, children planting trees, but we have to send soldiers along just to make sure that, you know, you do nothing wrong. So four soldiers arrive with their whatever weapons they have, and they're standing there with their guns, and they're watching the kids. And within about 15 minutes, one of the soldiers laid his gun against a tree and was helping the children. And within 25 minutes, all four soldiers were working away with the kids to plant the trees.
Wow.
I just love that because it's trees and the earth and nature and resilience and how children and nature can bring people together.
Mm, that is very touching. You probably have come across Mel Duncan. That's what it made me think of. And the Nonviolent Peace Force?
No.
Oh, really? This is a man you should meet. Mel Duncan actually takes teams into countries to recover children that have been kidnapped to be soldiers.
Oh, wow.
And they go in without arms, okay, and they get the kids back.
Easy.
They're peacekeepers. CW.
Yeah.
Enjoy this woman.
Yeah, I'm just in awe to be blessed with your presence, Ms. Goodall. Such a great humanitarian. You've written over 24 books, 10 of them children's books, over 17 films, over 80 awards. You've probably lost count on most of them. I have a couple of questions. You got any more books coming out? Any more films you're going to be doing?
Well, you know about the film Jane's Journey. I'm sure you do.
We put it on the radio today, but go ahead and tell us again.
Well, Jane's Journey was conceived of by a German filmmaker, and it took over 4 years to get the money for it. It's a cinema film, and he was so passionate to make this that he turned down other offers. He's an independent filmmaker, and turned them down, and eventually at the last minute, the money came through. It was a recession, you see, and so various Americans had said, yeah, they'd fund the film, and then at the last minute they said, well, really sorry, but we can't do it. However, the money came through. Then it was 2 years of filming. It was a year of editing. And what Lorenz wanted to do was he watched me give a lecture. He watched the children watching and listening. And he said, I've got to find out why it is that people listen like this and come to her lectures. And I want to find out who the woman is behind the person standing on the platform. So that was the sort of premise that he started with. And, of course, the photography is fantastic and the sound is brilliant. And amazing people are saying amazing things. And it's kind of strange for me to see my life laid out like that. But it's done extraordinarily well in Europe, where it's been in the cinemas. And now it just arrives here.
Why only one day?
Oh, well, one day is the this is the Fathom event on the 20th.
Right.
and it shows in 500 cinemas across the country. And it's been shown, the trailer's been shown for 3 weeks or so before the film is shown. However, the film is being distributed by First Run, which is a small distribution company. It already premiered in New York. I was there about 5 days ago.
Really?
Yes, and it will premiere in Los Angeles on the 23rd.
Oh, really?
Yes.
How do we get in there?
Well, it'll be playing for about 2 weeks, I think.
Oh, see, I thought it was only on for 1 day, and that's why
that's
I was so
concerned.
That's
a separate deal, the 27th. But it's also First Run. I think I even may be able to tell you the cinema it's on at. But anyway, it's certainly running for a couple of weeks.
Oh, that's excellent. I was really concerned because I have a meeting that I attend religiously on Tuesday evening. So this, you made me a happy woman, and we can actually play this for you more frequently because we're going to be playing this Saturday for you, and I was making all of this happen in time so that we could have it for the people would know about what you were doing for the 27th. So that's great.
Yes, it will be on for – here it is. It's Lemley's Monica.
Oh, yeah, I love these guys.
Lemley's Monica, yes. Okay.
I wanted to ask.
I know you've got another question, CW.
Opening on the 23rd, yes.
Ms. Goodall, Dr. Val shared with you my background in emergency management.
Yes.
During your research and observation there at Gombe Stream National Park all those years, did the families, when they were met with the crisis, did they have like their own way of dealing with emergencies and first aid? Can you share some of that with us?
I mean the Tanzanian families.
No. I'm talking about the chimpanzee families.
Oh, the chimpanzees. Well, the chimpanzees. You know, they live in communities, and the community is about 50 individuals. And within that community, of course, you get the males, and they patrol the boundaries of the territory, and they're very aggressively territorial. And then the females are there with their offspring, and sometimes they all join together in big, excited groups.
Do the males have more than one mate?
It's almost completely promiscuous in that when a female is sexually receptive, she may be mated by basically all the males, although there's an incest taboo.
What do you mean an incest taboo? Well, you don't do your children or something?
The sons don't mate with their mothers. And
really?
Mating between siblings is rare as well.
So when it comes to actually bringing up the offspring, does it change or is it done by the community?
No, the offspring is the sole responsibility of the mother.
Oh, and the father just goes out and has a beer.
Well, we don't. You know, we only know who the father is by doing DNA profiling. So there's no permanent pair bonds. There's no monogamous pair bonds.
Well, I just know that in certain cultures, the males are protective of their offspring.
Well, the males of Gombe, the community males protect all of the offspring within their community. It's as though they're paternal to all of them, which makes sense since they probably don't know who their own offspring are.
There's an element of humor to that. Jane, is it fair to ask you how old you are?
Yes, if you want to. I'm 77.
77. I'm 71, okay?
You're a baby.
I know. I'm a whippersnapper, okay? And I'll never catch up with you.
No, you'll never catch up. Well, yes, you will. When I die, if you go on, you can surpass me.
Well, let me tell you something. I've actually been taking this stuff called Protandin, and I love it a whole lot. My energy has come back tremendously. I was just looking at it on the desk and thinking, well, maybe I will catch up with her. I love what you've been doing. So if you're 70...
Did I properly answer the question that I was just asked about? Because I'm not sure I answered.
I think you did. I asked you if the males took care of if the males took care of their own, and what you said was they took care of the entire group.
About the chimpanzees.
She's referring to, I was asking about how they reacted to crisis within the family and how they deal with injuries and first aid and so forth.
I knew I hadn't answered it properly. So injuries, they medicate themselves to some extent.
How do they do that?
Well, they dab at wounds with leaves. They lick. They certainly deal with internal parasites. They eat certain leaves that the local people eat as well. And if an infant is sick, the mother will carry the child around with her. And if the mother is sick, the offspring are very upset. They don't know what to do, though. But I've seen a 3-year-old infant very, very concerned when his elder brother got a great gash on his thigh.
Mm.
He sat for the longest time holding the lip of the wound together.
Oh.
I mean, it was very charming, and then grooming all around. And so they, you know, they don't really know what to do, but they do show a lot of compassion.
Do you know about the gorilla in the Kent Zoo that's walking upright?
Oh, they often do. Chimps do as well.
Well, I guess this gorilla actually spends most of his time upright.
Yeah, there are some chimps that do that as well. That wouldn't happen in the wild. It's one of the chimps who walks upright all the time is because he was kept in a sort of bit like a parrot cage. So he had to be upright.
Mm-hmm.
Another one at Gombe walked upright all the time because he got polio in one arm. And if he walked on three limbs, the limp arm dragged along the ground, which wasn't a good thing. So he learned to walk upright.
Are you wondering what I am about intelligence, CW, about the comparisons or the gifts that the chimps have that we might consider intelligence?
I'm wondering about that, and I'm wondering about the rumor I've heard.
And rumor?
That you greet everybody in chimpanzee when you're in front of a crowd. Is that true?
Absolutely. With the distance greeting call, the pantoot, we call it. I always do that.
Well, let's hear it.
Can we be greeting?
It's a bit loud, so I'll hold the phone away. Okay?
Yes, please.
What is it?
I heard that sound in a bedroom before.
Now.
Well, and there's also a greeting when two chimpanzees greet when they've been separated, and they'll approach and put their arms around each other and kiss. I mean, they're very human-like in so many ways. The postures,
that is so awesome.
The gestures, the biology, the structure of the brain, and of course they show intellectual abilities we used to think unique to us.
What about memory? What's their memory?
Oh, very, very long. I mean, nobody knows how long they remember, but it's absolutely for sure that they can remember for at least 14 years because they've remembered somebody that they knew 14 years ago. And this was a signing chimp who'd been taught sign language, and she immediately made the two name signs that she'd been taught for these two people.
Oh, my gosh. Do you know Tippi Hedren?
Yes.
Tippi, have you ever been to her Shambhala?
No.
Well, she had an elephant at Shambhala,
yes.
And I
yes.
don't remember the name of it. Did you happen to hear that story?
No,
okay,
I might have done.
I guess they were going to put down an elephant that was in Canada, something like that.
Yes.
And she heard about it, and she said, no, 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 send the elephant over here. And they had, I don't quite remember whether she already had an elephant there, but when the elephants got together, it turned out that they had been shipped over on the boat from Africa over 20 years before.
Yes, absolutely.
And they totally remembered each other,
yes.
And they totally got ecstatic, and this was like 20, 25 years they hadn't seen each other.
That's exactly, yes, I indeed know that story.
Have you seen the story of the elephant that paints?
Yes.
Tell me, have you any conversation about that? Have you seen anything like that with chimps?
Well, a lot of elephants paint. You know, they use their trunk, and people realized it when one elephant got bored and started using a rock and making white scrape marks on the ground. And it turned out when the elephant was contented, he made nice sweeping circles. And when he was angry and hungry, he made jagged up and down circles. So, you know, it's very much like the way some psychiatrists use art.
Like Rorschach tests?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, the elephant that I saw, And by the way, CW, it's on the internet somewhere. The elephant I saw actually painted a picture of itself.
Oh, well, I don't know about that.
It painted an elephant. I watched the whole thing happen. It painted trunk, husk, tusks, the whole thing. It drew an elephant.
Where was that?
It's on the internet.
Where it was?
Gosh, it's been a year or so since I saw it.
Because I know the stuff going on in Thailand with the elephants.
I think that was Thai.
Yeah, well, it's very cruel, and they're more or less tortured to make those paintings.
Really? Sure didn't see that in the...
I was hearing some... I'm sure it's not true for all of the elephants, but it's not very nice, apparently.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that story. I didn't see any suffering going on the part of this elephant. I saw the elephant just pick up a paintbrush and start drawing an elephant, and I was just like, OMG. And I was wondering if...
I think that, I mean, of course elephants are amazingly intelligent, and I always thought, I mean, I was always saying, well, give an elephant a paintbrush. I'm sure they do as well as chimps.
See, they heard
they
you.
They do, yeah, because chimps paint as well.
Do they?
Yes, and they have schema, and it's been analyzed by, you know, art professors, and it's fascinating, actually, chimp art.
Are you thinking, CW, we should go see some chimp art?
I'm ready.
Where will we go?
I'm not sure. They had an exhibition in London of chimp art, and they didn't say it was chimp art. They said it was this new school of painting, and they had all these critics come and make complete fools of themselves, talking about, you know, what lay behind these lines and everything, and they were so angry when they found it was chimp art. It's a really funny story.
So if you were born in 1933 or 1934, right? Okay.
34.
When did you get into the world of chimps, and how did that happen?
Well, because I always loved animals, and I read Dr. Doolittle when I was 8, and then I've read and fell in love with Tarzan, the books, not the films. There were no films at that time, when I was 11. And that's when I decided I would grow up, go to Africa, live with animals, and write books about them.
What did your parents do at
that
time?
Well, my father was off fighting in the war. World War II was raging. Africa was still the dark continent. We didn't have any money. I mean, you know, not enough even for a bicycle. And I was a girl. Girls didn't do that sort of thing.
Except you did.
So everybody laughed at me and told me that I should think about things I could achieve, except my amazing mother, who said, if you want something and you really work hard and you never give up, you'll find a way. So I eventually saved up enough money to get to Africa, no degree, couldn't afford university, worked as a waitress to get out there, met the late Louis Leakey, the famous paleontologist, and it was he who gave me this opportunity, because he just apparently saw that I really was passionate about animals, that I didn't mind being out in the wild, that I didn't care about parties and clothes and hair and things like that. And so finally managed to get a little bit of money and sent me off.
And that would be what year?
That was 1960. So I went to Africa in 57 and then spent a year back in England while he found the money and got the permission.
What would be... Go ahead,
you,
CW.
You started, and you didn't have an education, but in 64, you didn't you attend Cambridge, and don't you have a PhD now?
Right. Lewis wrote and told me I had to get a degree to get money for myself. He wouldn't always be around to get money for me. And
okay.
So it was actually in the middle of 1961, or the end of 61, that I went to Cambridge to do a PhD, because he said there was no time for a BA. And
okay. Go straight to the PhD.
Me I'd done everything wrong. I shouldn't have given the chimps names. That wasn't scientific. They should have had numbers. And I couldn't talk about mind or feelings or personality, because those were unique to us.
And it wouldn't qualify for a good doctoral paper if you did that, right?
Well, that was, you know, but fortunately... I thought back to the teacher I had as a child, and I knew that the professors were wrong, although they were very erudite, no doubt. And that teacher, this teacher that surely one of you two know, was my dog, Percy. I mean, you can't live with an animal. You can't share your life with an animal and not know that they have personalities, not know that they can think some things through and definitely have happiness, feelings of happiness, sadness, fear, and so forth, just like us.
I actually had a black Labrador with a sense of humor. And whenever she would do something, she'd like look over and kind of like wink a bit. And it was just like, it would give me a chill every time that she did it. And CW, Carol's got a number of dogs. I'm sure some of them are extraordinary.
In a way, she'd be honored to be here, but I'm glad she's not. We wouldn't get to this in half a day. Carol has she's rescued 7 dogs and approximately 20, I'll lost count, 25, 26 cats. And
yes,
they're all with us. And we have this one dog called Alfie. And it's funny you would say wink, Dr. Val. He jumped up on my lap last night, and I really didn't want nothing to do with him. And he's got his paws on my chest, just staring into my eyes, and his left eye blinks, and he gives me that wink. And I'm thinking, oh, Lord. So I had to spend some time with him, of course. And Alfie is a bit strange. I think he's a bit strange, though, because if I'm away any length of time throughout the day, I come home, he's the first dog to come and jump up on me, and when I reach over to pet him, he pees on me.
That is very bizarre.
So anymore when I get home,
he must be claiming you as his territory.
Could be, but I push him away a little bit before I pet him.
I would hope so.
Jane, have you ever had a time when you were concerned or afraid for what was going to happen when you were working with these animals?
Well, the chimps are very strong. They're about 10 times stronger than me. And there is one who is a very scary individual. He's in this film, actually, James Journey. He comes very peaceful in the film. He comes and stands beside me. But he's huge, and he loves to knock people over. He's a bully. He's a bully with other chimps as well as people. And I try to avoid him, actually. He's really not nice.
How do you handle that?
You can't. I mean, there's nothing you can do. Just hope I won't see him when he's in a bad mood.
It's just such a powerful, unscripted thing you do. You can't tell what they're going to do, can you?
No, but after a while, I mean, we've been at it 50 years now. We have a great research team there. We're analyzing all the data in Duke University. And certainly you can learn to predict a little bit and know what sort of mood they're in and, you know, certainly know all the different individuals and how they're likely to behave.
Over your 50 years, what would you say is are a couple of the most remarkable things that came to you out of your work?
Well, I suppose, you know, overall it's how like us they are in so many different ways, and it helps us to understand that we're part of the animal kingdom and not separated from it. And then, you know, certain wonderful stories, like the first chimp who lost his fear of me was David Greybeard. And one day I was following him through the forest. I lost him. And I came upon him sitting as though he was waiting for me, which maybe he was.
Probably was.
And there was a ripe fruit lying on the ground, so I held it towards him with my hand, on the palm of my hand. And he obviously didn't want it, so he turned his head away. And I pushed my hand closer, and he looked directly in my eyes, reached out, took the fruit, deliberately dropped it, and then very gently squeezed my hand, which is how chimpanzees reassure each other. So it was an absolute perfect communication between beings of two different worlds, probably using the sort of language that early humans used before they developed words.
Would you be giving that chimp an age if you were comparing him to a child?
Well, chimps can live to be 70.
70?
Yes. So David Greybeard was fully adult at that time. He was probably around 27 years old, something like that.
What do you think his vocabulary
Well, they don't really have a vocabulary. They mostly communicate with postures, sounds, gestures, and then many different calls signifying different, mostly emotions.
I was thinking in terms of when you were talking earlier about signing.
Well, the wild chimps, of course, don't sign. These are the chimps in captivity who've been taught American Sign Language.
Hmm. And what kind of vocabularies do they end up with?
They can learn up to 400.
That's a lot of words.
I know. And there's a chimpanzee in Japan. She's called Ai, which means love. And, I mean, she's absolutely incredible. She doesn't know sign language, but she works with a computer. And she can do things with her touchpad quicker than, well, probably most high school students. And her son, Ayumu, who's now 9, has defeated... people come from all over to try and defeat him. He's like an enfant savant. He's got the most extraordinary telegraphic, or I think that's the word, memory. So you show him numbers from 0 to 9 in a different, you know, different order each time. And within a couple of seconds, he's got that whole thing memorized and it disappears from the screen and he replicates it.
If you attached an IQ to that, what would you be attaching?
I don't want to do that.
And I got it.
The IQ test doesn't really work because you test a chimp and you say it's got an IQ of a 3 to 4 year old, but that's only in certain human-oriented ways. And an adult chimpanzee in many ways has an intelligence that's, you know, it equals us in other ways. It's not sensible to give animals an IQ based on human IQ, I don't think.
Well, Piaget says we always compare things, so I was just following Piaget's.
Yes, I know. And everyone does it, you'll find that, but I don't.
No, I appreciate the, I'm not going to say the correction, but the clarification. I totally appreciate that. I'm so dumbfounded by how all of this works that I guess I want to measure it against something. CW, we've got a couple minutes left here because what we're going to do is let people know how to watch the movie again and thank Emergency Management Solutions, Jason Winter T. And what can I say? What would you like to say to this wonderful woman as we wrap it up here?
Well, Ms. Goodall, you and I just met for the first time, but I'm going to ask you for a favor.
Okay.
Don't stop. Please don't stop.
Ever.
Ever.
Well, I tell you, now you have to hear a funny story. I was walking through the lobby of a crowded hotel. It was the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City, and all the managers and all the wealthy people were there prior to the games. And I'm just walking across the foyer, and they had hired a lot of bellhops, and they were all dressed in white. Suddenly, one of these young men leaps in my path, points a finger at me, and dramatically declares in a very loud voice, "Don't you ever dare die! We need you!" And everybody's head spun round.
Oh!
It was marvelous.
Oh, that is absolutely terrific.
Yes.
So once again, we want people to go and visit your film this coming week on the 27th when it will be in 500 theaters. Since it's in more places than Fathom Events, where else would you recommend that people find it? The Lumley Theaters? Is it playing any place else?
Well, it's only playing in that one cinema that I mentioned in, what did I say it was?
Monica,
that's right. Yeah, Santa Monica.
I know. It's really 20 minutes from me. You guess I'm going to be there.
Be there, yes. Well, and it's, I mean, I can't pronounce this word. It's L-A-E-M-M-L.
Lemley.
Lemley.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
But you were saying that you had been to the opening in New York and that it was playing in other places, so.
Yes, it's still playing in New York, I think, in the IFC Center. And it's going to open in Seattle on October the 7th.
So it is, they will be able to find it the rest of this year.
I'm sure, and I don't know more than that because that's all that's on my list. It's going to Portland, and we expect that it will sort of get picked up by other cinemas you know, if the reviews are good, which I hope they will be.
Well, one of our members of our radio team is Dr. Rutledge Taylor, and I want you to be aware of him because he's actually done work in Africa with regards to DDT. Are you familiar with this conversation at all?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so in the length of time that we've been recording this call, 500 children have died of malaria, and it's totally avoidable. So that's part of, you know, I'm wanting to put together a network of people and ideas that makes a difference, and CW has just been an incredible person in my life helping that to become true, and he and I do a program on Wednesdays called Waking Up in America and another one on Saturdays called Our American Cafe, and I'm going to have this program played this Saturday so that people can have the benefit of the 27th.
Terrific. Thanks so much.
So just thank you very much for your work, and as CW said, don't ever stop.
I won't stop as long as I'm alive. Okay, is that good enough?
You sound very healthy.
Oh, I am. I don't know why.
Do you have any secrets of health? Is that just living your life greatly?
I think that's the secret of health. I mean, I don't eat meat. I believe that's a huge benefit, and I'm active, and I don't think about my health at all in any way. Works.
Yeah, it does totally, huh?
Yeah.
So what I want to say to you is, you know, just incredibly thank you. Now that I know how to get a hold of you, I may follow up on things that you're doing.
Okay.
Is there something past this peace program this past week that you'd like to know, you'd like to have our listening audience know what you're up to?
Well, when I was made a messenger of peace, you have a little dove pinned on your lapel. And so one of our Roots and Shoots young men made, to celebrate this, a giant peace dove. And it was made out of recycled sheets, and it flew, in quotes, on four poles, wings, head. The head was chicken wire covered in sheets with the eyes painted on and the beak painted. And so during this week, the Roots and Shoots groups around the world will be flying peace doves, having processions, flying them on boats and cars, on the ocean, on the lake, on rivers, on tops of tall buildings. You know, people have lots of imagination. And it's very powerful.
You have a design for this on one of your websites,
yes.
Don't you?
Giant peace dove on the janegoodall.org website.
So check that out, folks. Go to Jane Goodall. Is it? It's a .org, right?
Yes. www.janegoodall.org.
And yes, Jane Goodall is alive and well and creating peace doves all over the place and a UN peace messenger, and we're so honored to have connected with you today. Thank you very much. This program has been brought to you by Kirkgaard Media, our radio partners, ConingCompany.com, Dr. James Murphy in memoriam. He's the one that made me promise to him on his deathbed after the State of the World Forum that I would carry the torch for peace until I died. And DrValerie.com, and doctor is all spelled out. And we thank our producer, C.W. Wright, of Emergency Management Solutions, JasonLinterT.com. And we thank you, Ron Hayes, our research assistant, and also to our team at Cumulus Radio, and that'd be you, Mike. And we thank you for our theme music, Almost Ordinary People, by Bent Miguin. Next week, invite a friend to listen. We're doing a recorded conversation this week because we're actually going to be gathering together for the Republic to actually create more freedom in America. So I just loved having you here today. Sidious, Altius, Fortius, swifter, higher, stronger. That's the Torchbearer's Creed. Carry the torch for peace. This is the week. And the 27th of September, go see Jane. Take care.
And you're not crazy anymore.
Thank you for joining us today for Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkgaard. Waking Up in America can be heard live every Wednesday on voiceamerica.com, and Valerie welcomes all emails at heavenincorporated.com.
This is for all you knew, pouring through. Now your heart is